There's an old joke about three guys who are having a drink up on top of one of those rooftop bars in Manhattan. And the first guy turns to the second guy and he says, "You know, the updraft off the side of these buildings is so strong that if you were to fall off the edge, the draft would catch you and blow you back up on top of the building." And the second guy says, "No way, you're crazy." And the first guy says, "No, really, really, watch." And he goes to the edge of the building and he jumps off. And he falls about two or three stories and whoosh, comes flying right back up on top of the building. And the second guy says, "Wow, that's amazing." And, you know, he's had a couple drinks, so he said, "I'm going to try it." So he goes to the edge and he jumps off and splat, he lands on the pavement. The third guy turns to the first guy and he says, "You know, Superman, you're a jerk when you drink." Now, I share that joke because, oddly enough, that joke helped me to understand a little better one of the misconceptions I had about Jesus. And I think maybe sometimes we tend to view Jesus the same way that we see Superman in that joke. He does this amazing, miraculous, superhuman, otherworldly thing, and then turns to us and says, "Do as I do. Follow my example." We just read in John 13, look at verse 15. This is what Jesus says. He says, "I have given you an example that you should do just as I have done to you." And that's a common message all through the life of Jesus. It's part of his calling to his disciples and to us that we should do as he does. In the next chapter, chapter 14, he says in verse 12, he says, "I say to you, truly, truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do. And greater works than these will he do, because I am going to the Father." We're really, I think, quite clear of this concept that Jesus wants us to follow his example. Jesus wants us to do as he did. But I think too often we think of it a little bit like Superman, you know, jumping off a skyscraper and then telling us that we should do that as well. And that's really not the point that Jesus is trying to make. That's not the example that Jesus is calling us to. That's not what Jesus' ministry is. Now sure, Peter asked to join Jesus when he was walking on the water. Maybe that's what comes to your mind. And when Jesus asked him to come, Peter did walk out a bit to be with him. But that isn't really what Jesus required of Peter. It wasn't Jesus' idea. And it's not what he asked for us. If you keep reading there in John 14, a little bit further down, we see a pretty good summary of what Jesus wants from us. Look at John 14, verse 15. "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." That is all that Jesus wants from us. He doesn't expect miracles from us. He doesn't expect us to walk on the water or to jump off a tall building and not get hurt. All he really wants from us is to keep his commandments. John says the same thing in 1 John chapter 5. He says, "This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments." Take a look at it. Turn up 1 John chapter 5. Or maybe you can quote the rest of that verse. 1 John chapter 5, verse 3. "This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome." His commandments are not burdensome. Burdensome. What Jesus asks of us is really not that hard. It's not something that requires, you know, superhuman effort. You know, something that really requires an amazing amount of faith. I think the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of that, I thought of that, was the lawyer, when that lawyer tested Jesus. It's in Matthew 22. Matthew 22, verse 35. One of them, a lawyer, asks a question to test him. Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? So this is a guy who spent his whole life, you know, studying the detail and all the nuances of this law. And he comes to Jesus, and he says he's testing him, but I think he kind of really wants to know what answer Jesus is going to give. You know, what is the great commandment out of all the things there? And Jesus says to him in verse 37, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." Jesus doesn't come up with some really complex or confusing example. He doesn't say, well, it's really important to do this sacrifice the certain way and to kill the animal and to place the blood on your ear and do, you know, all these different things. This guy comes to Jesus. He's really trying to catch him in his words. He really thought that he could stump him by trying to find out if Jesus would commit to saying which one of the hundreds of commandments is the most important. I'm sure he was thinking that Jesus would pick something very difficult. And Jesus says, "Love the Lord your God." That's it. Love God. That's really what Jesus wants from us as well. And of course, connected to that is the next thought, love your neighbor as yourself. You don't have to be Superman to do this. You don't have to have the Holy Spirit without limit. You don't have to be the miraculous Son of God. You don't have to be some sinless, perfect deity in order to obey him. The example that Christ gave us is really quite simple for us to understand. And it's simple for us to follow through on. It isn't saying I'm trying to lessen the importance of Christ being the Son of God, and that he was blessed with these miraculous powers. But the real example that Christ wants us to follow is the life that he led. He simply led a kind and considerate and loving life. And he asked us to do the same. Let's look at Matthew 25. Matthew 25, we see the famous passage about the judgment, the time that we are all looking forward to. In Matthew 25, verse 34, "The king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food, I was thirsty and you gave me drink, I was a stranger and you welcomed me, I was naked and you clothed me, I was sick and you visited me, I was in prison, you came to me.' Then the righteous will answer, saying, 'Lord, when do we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When do we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? When do we see you in sick or in prison and visit you?' And the king will answer him, 'Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me.'" We often talk about how we want to hear those words, "Come, you were blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom provided for you from the foundation of the world." And look at the kind of person that he says that to. Not someone who's done, you know, amazing things and miraculous feats. Someone who's welcoming and warm to a stranger. Someone who gives someone something to eat when they're hungry. Someone who offers to provide clothing for people who are down on their luck. Someone who takes the time to go to the hospital and visit the sick and the lonely. The types of actions that should fill our life are not superhuman. God doesn't require us to do something that's unbelievably hard. He simply wants us to do what's right, what's kind. Let's look at the chapter we read, John 13, because that really is the example that Jesus is talking about. John 13, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of the world. Something that none of us would ever be able to experience, to know that you're going to die in the next 72 hours. If there was ever a time for his faith to falter, if there was ever a time when he would feel weak, start to shake, this would be it. It's actually time. It's that moment that he's dreaded his whole life. He's known about this since he was 12. What does he do when he realizes that this is the time that he has to face the end? Having loved his own, he loved them to the end. Verse 2, during supper, when the devil had already put it in the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God. Notice what that is saying. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. Jesus knew that he had unlimited power from God. He was literally the second most powerful deity in the universe, entity in the whole universe. And what does he do? Verse 4, he rose from supper, he laid aside his outer garments, he took a towel, he tied it around his waist, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. And Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, washes their feet. We don't even understand, I don't think, what really it means when it talks about washing someone's feet. For us, I think we think more of like a pedicure. You know, you go into the mall and they put your feet in that little warm bucket of water and scrub your cuticles and massage you. And it's a nice thing. It would be a nice feeling for someone to wash your feet. If I were to wash your feet, to pour a basin of water and take your sweaty socks off and wash your feet, that would feel nice. This isn't about nice. This is about gross. Gross and disgusting. You see, where they lived, the cities didn't have sewers. And you just carried your bucket out into the street and you dumped it in the street in front of your house. And everybody walked around in sandals. Maybe they hadn't invented socks yet, I don't know. But they walked around in sandals. They were barefoot. And their feet got covered in some terrible things. I mean, all kinds of cows and all kinds of donkeys and horses and sheep and dogs. And on top of that, your neighbor who threw his bucket out. Washing someone's feet, it was such a gross job that not only would you not do it or ask your spouse to do it, you really wouldn't even ask your children to do it. It was a job for a house slave. Thankfully, the land was full of so many illegal aliens, and they were so poor that they would work in your house for pennies. And you could just have them do all the really gross, dirty jobs that no one wanted to do, like emptying all those buckets every day and washing your feet. But this dinner was put together hastily with very little time, and they had forgot to make arrangements. It wouldn't have cost them any money at all. But they had forgot to have someone there to take care of the feet. So in walks everybody. And you walk in the front door and you pause. And then there's this awkward moment as they all look around and realize that they forgot to organize a house slave. They forgot to arrange someone to be there to wash their feet. So it's gross to bring it to the dinner table, but they do. They go in, they sit down, and they have dinner because none of them are going to volunteer to do that. And then that awkwardness turns even more awkward as Jesus stands up. He takes off his jacket. He rolls his sleeves up. He ties a towel around his waist. And before people can even fathom that the unthinkable is about to happen, Jesus bends down. And in verse 5, he pours water into a basin and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around them. Everyone is speechless and stunned as he works his way around the room, and in turn he washes each person's feet. I mean, I'm trying to think of an analogy that makes sense in our life. So try to imagine Barack Obama is coming to your house for dinner. He's visiting the Reagan Library, and as a promotion, the city of Simi Valley has randomly pulled a name out of a hat, and you're the one that gets to host the president for dinner. And after dinner, he asks to use your restroom. And you're a little bit nervous because you hope you've cleaned it enough and it's properly, and everything looks nice in there, you know, for him. You say yes, and he goes into the bathroom, and after a really awkward amount of time, you realize that he hasn't come out. And you hear some noise rustling in there. And you go and check on him, and you find out that the toilet has overflowed like it does because you're supposed to clean it, but you haven't, and you haven't done a good job of keeping it up. And here he is in there, and he's taken his shoes off, and he's rolled his pant legs up, and he's taken the plunger out from behind the toilet, and he's plunging the toilet, and he's taken some paper towels, and he's trying to mop up the floor, and he's on his hands and knees in the bathroom cleaning up your poop off the floor. That's not really how you imagined that evening was going to go, was it? This is the same thing that happened that night. And Peter just can't stand it. Look at him in verse 6. He came to Peter. It's Peter's turn. And Peter says, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" And Jesus answered, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but afterwards you will understand." And Peter said, "Well, you should never wash my feet." And Jesus answered him. Notice Peter says, "I should wash yours." No, he doesn't say that. Jesus says, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." And Peter says, "Okay, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." But Jesus said, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but it is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you. For he knew who was to betray him." That was why he said, "Not all of you are clean." So he works his way around the room. And to everyone's embarrassment, he's finished doing this awkward, uncomfortable job. And then they realize it wasn't just because they'd forgotten to hire somebody. He says in verse 12, when he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments again and resumed his place at the table, he says, "Do you understand what I've done to you?" And they realize it wasn't really about the washing of the feet at all. He says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet." You call me Lord, and you're right. I am. I am the Lord of all that I see. God has given everything into my hands, and I've chosen to wash your feet. you also ought to wash one another's feet. Jesus wanted to teach his disciples, and he wants to teach us. That's the kind of service he wants from us. It's not the great and the amazing that he calls us to. It's often the lowly and the simple. He wants us to roll up our sleeves, to get down on our knees, take a towel, and do some cleaning. For I have given you an example that you should do just as I have done to you. The example that Jesus gives us, the example he wants us to follow, is not Superman jumping off a building, but it's a lowly house slave kneeling down to wash some dirty feet.